No.
Then I'll do that, and we'll go until 2. Okay. Paul Rodell here again, the IVS Oral History Project. And tonight is June 18. It's about 10 o'clock, and I'm sitting in the, I guess, dining room area would be the proper way to say it, in the home of William, I believe, M. Taylor, who was in IVS Laos from 61 through 63. Which months, Bill?
July
of 61?
61 through July of 63.
Okay, full 2 years.
And then I was back with AID for two more years.
So for AID for two, and then after the IVS. Okay, first question to you, as to everyone else, because it wasn't on the yellow form, was a little bit of background about yourself, even, you know, when you were born, who your parents were, what they instilled in you, and how you grew up, all pointing towards the eventual decision to get involved in this organization for at least a couple years of your life. And that's it. Now, most of the time, I'm just going to sit back. The easy part.
Should I play this straight?
Straight or crooked.
Okay. I was born in Marshall, Missouri in May of 1935. And my parents, my father was at that time, a Southern Baptist minister who was somewhat unique in his time because he was a PhD in history and also was very liberal, having come from Oxford, Mississippi.
Uh-huh.
And this was always part of our family life, although that sometimes he had to keep a lid on it. And of course, at that time, Missouri was still considered, it was a segregated state, to segregated primary and junior high schools. And my mother was from Hopkinsville, Kentucky. And she was at that time the prototypical minister's wife. They worked as a team very closely. And I think one of the things that sparked my interest in rural travel and seeing other lands and foreign shores was the fact that we frequently had, of course, I was reminiscing this to somebody else who was completely astounded, maybe it was even Susan, I don't recall, that when I was growing up, particularly pre-World War II, but even during the Second World War, foreign missionaries were kind of heroes. You know, Livingston and Edna R. Judson, and we read these stories about them going off to these foreign places, and we weren't particularly interested in their saving their souls, but in the adventures that they had. And we had missionaries would come back from the so-called foreign field and would give services and presentations in the church, and they would stay in our home and sit around the dinner table relating their experiences, and I was an impressionable youth. And
they still do that too.
Yeah, they do, but not in our home. So
no, I mean coming to churches.
I know that very well. My sister, as it turned out, at one time it was in about 1962, I think. My sister was in Rhodesia, then it's now Zimbabwe,
mm-hmm.
and my brother was in Uganda. And I was in Laos, so all at the same time, all three of the kids in our family were, but anyway, then when I was approximately 13, we moved to Mansfield, Ohio. My father took a church there, and we lived lived in Marshall for 13 years and then moved to Mansfield, where he stayed, my father stayed in that church for 17 years until I was out of high school and out of college and back for my first tour in Laos before they moved to New York. And so that was kind of, I guess, some of the background. I don't know if that covers what you're interested in.
Well, no, but it's whatever you would, you know, point to as some of the stuff that motivated you.
I think that's, I'm not sure. I think just what we spoke about has a lot to do with what motivated me. I always read a lot. I dreamed a lot. I, read every, book. I don't know, not every book, but many books on these various places. And, we took the National Geographic, and I've just always been fascinated with other countries and other cultures.
Yeah.
And,
Well, why IVS, though?
Well, when I was a senior in veterinary school,
Because Peace Corps was started by then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Was Peace Corps started by then? It was so rudimentary.
It was rudimentary.
It was just barely getting started in 61. And I was graduating from veterinary school, and I was interested in overseas work.
Okay.
And I just began scouting around for various opportunities. And I got a list of agencies that sponsored agricultural technicians in different countries, and I guess IVS was on it.
Yeah.
Also, I had a roommate in veterinary school who had been very active in the International Farm Youth Exchange Program as a student. He'd been in Portugal as an exchange student, etc. And he had known of IVS too, I believe. So I got this list of things, and IVS was looking for agricultural technicians in Laos. And gee, at that time, had not been too much before that, that there had been an article in National Geographic, I think, on Laos, the last Shangri-La. Of course, I'd read Tom Dooley's books. And in fact, I'd actually heard Tom Dooley speak. He had come to Ohio State when I was in veterinary school, and one of these traveling lecture programs, and I and a young lady attended Dr. Dooley's presentation. And so when I saw an opening in Laos, I thought, gee, what would be more interesting and exotic and exciting to go to than Laos? And I applied and accepted.
What was it like to hear Dooley speak? Because I read some of his books.
What was it like to hear him speak? He was a good speaker. Very interesting. Of course, he was, I would say a strong personality. Of course, this was in a big auditorium with thousands of people, and I was sitting up in the balcony, so.
Well, that many people came out for him.
Yeah, okay. Hundreds anyway. It was a big Mershom Auditorium in Ohio State. It was the main auditorium on the campus where they had their lecture series there. I presume that the hall was pretty well filled. That was not too long after his books had been published, and he was a child of the Reader's Digest. They had excerpted his books, and of course the first one was about when he was in the Navy and helped refugees flee from North Vietnam to South Vietnam, and took care of them. And then he got this inspiration to come back to Southeast Asia, and for some, I don't recall why, but he ended up in Laos rather than South Vietnam, and up in I have to look at the map, remember anymore, but up in the north of Laos, and when I was in Laos, I had occasion to go up there and visit where his hospital was. By that time, I don't think he was deceased, but he was no longer up there. And several rather strange causes had taken over his efforts. The American Airlines stewardesses and some Peggy E. Lee was sponsoring the Dobbs Really? Lee Foundation, yeah.
Oh, wow.
So, but anyway.
Peggy Lee, not Pinky Lee.
No, Peggy Lee. Yeah, okay. I don't mean Pinky Lee.
Okay.
She's the blues and, jazz singer.
No, I think he was...
No, I'm talking about Peggy E. Lee.
Peggy yeah. Lee, yeah. Yeah. Okay, because I've always wanted... I've read some of his books, too.
Yeah.
And... doesn't surprise me that a lot of people would have come out to hear him.
Yeah, at that time he was very well known.
Oh yeah. Yeah, almost a household name in a sense. I mean, when the Kingston Trio sang Hang Down Your Head, Tom Dooley, I thought it was, the wrong one,
A lot of people did. What did he do?
I was scratching my head, wait a minute.
Old Doc Tom.
Yeah. So yeah, he was that much a household name that I guess in elementary school, maybe high school, I immediately identified with it. So, okay, so what kind of training did they give you?
None.
Okay.
Zero. We had I used to kind of smile in amusement. We had it was Esther Camphausen that I mentioned, and Tom Volkner and George Reidenauer, or Harold Volkner and George Reidenauer, Bob Ziegler, and three or four of the local kids who were kind of quasi-translators and interpreters, and the field assistants went out to a little place outside of any town called Burma Village. And it's called Burma Village because there were some originally some Burmese refugees there.
Okay.
And we decided we were going to do a little community project out there. We, IBS had rented a little bamboo thatch roof house, and we went out there and tried to plant a garden and fiddly farted around and we wore our sarongs and nampas and thought we had gone Navy, but we did that for a couple of weeks, I think, and that was about our training.
That was it, huh?
Yeah.
Oh, gosh. That's hardly much of a training.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Well, we essentially didn't have any training.
Yeah. A little orientation in Washington and then out? Or?
Yeah, and the orientation, I remember George Ride and I went over together and we stayed in a little hotel in Washington and met a man named Goffsinger, who at that time was the director, and he took us out to his house, and we were awed by all of his collection of furniture and things from Southeast Asia, and pretty impressed, and we chatted a little bit, and I don't remember too much about what we chatted for. We were given airline tickets and taken out to Dulles, and
bye-bye.
And away we went.
Oh, no, that's...
Grand adventure.
Yeah, well, yeah, I guess the philosophy was, well, drop them in, they'll learn.
Yeah. Well, we did.
Yeah, and you would.
After 4 years?
Yeah, well.
Knew a little bit, not a whole lot.
So, let's see, some of the questions here. Your work, you said veterinary advisor and the community development stuff. What would it really involve, though?
This was so, I was involved in so many things, and it was so long gone, I'm going to have to kind of organize my thoughts, and I don't want to waste your battery.
Don't worry about that.
We arrived almost simultaneously, very shortly thereafter, Conley's coup d'etat, and Vientiane was in a state of upheaval. My AID counterpart, a gentleman named John McQueen, very nice man, and several other AID about four AID personnel had been captured by, I think it was Congolese troops, and held captive in the little residence apartment that aid had in Vientiane, where we stayed for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And John McQueen, understandably, had been scared to death.
Yeah, yeah.
He was a fine man, and he certainly wasn't anybody's, I wouldn't even know what I characterize him as, a chicken. But when you get in a room with people who are thinking about killing you, and pointing guns at you and dry firing them and things like that, it's
that's not being a coward. Yeah, that's just being human.
He was, and so John had decided right then all he wanted to do was get home alive.
Yeah,
he was going to do the minimum necessary. I was assigned veterinary advisor to the Royal Lao government, which was kind of a heady title for an IDS volunteer, because most of the volunteers were working in education and community development. So, and my counterpart was the director of the Royal Lao Veterinary Services. And he was a prince, child someone or another, and he graduated from the veterinary school in Paris, France. The only degreed veterinarian in Laos. And of course he was nothing but a bureaucratic politician. And then each province had a veterinary hospital, veterinary office for the veterinary services. And they were doing absolutely nothing. They had a few rusty syringes and antiquated instruments, and no training. And I would fly around the country, usually with someone from, possibly from AID, not necessarily, possibly with someone from the Royal Lao government. Sometimes they would just send a telegram that I was coming and treat me cordially. And I would go out and I would to the provincial capitals and meet with these gentlemen, and they would show me around and have a basse, remember that term, and a meal, and they would give me their wish list of things they wanted and tell me of all their hardships, and indeed they were hardships. They didn't know anything, they didn't have anything, they were out there isolated by themselves. And if they sent out vaccinators, by that time the Viet Cong or the Pathet Lao were pretty well in control of the countryside. They would shoot the vaccinators. They were essentially trying to keep intact the veterinary service that the French had set up. And it was just in shambles. And we would get them supplies, and I would take them out to them, and we. But if they weren't sold on the black market, they were just put in a refrigerator that didn't work, and allowed to become outdated. Very little of anything ever happened from them. We went on some forays where there were actually some vaccinations carried out, but I hadn't been there too long when the director of the veterinary services and several of the other national level bureaucrats organized a soiree up into Siaburi province. We were to go up there, go from village to village. Are you familiar with the Operation Brotherhood?
Yes, very much.
They sent a doctor, a Filipino doctor, and several human medical personnel. And then, and it was essentially a showing the flag type of operation, going, we went by elephant and from village to village, and all the villagers would
love to have done that.
to meet us, and you know, the other little school children would form a line, and through it like you were actually somewhat important. Mm-hmm. And we went all through Northern Cyber Province.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a very interesting. It's where I learned to eat lop luet.
Which is?
Lop luet. Lop is chopped up. It would be the Laotian version of a steak tartare. They take any meat from buffalo to duck and chop it into a fine hamburger or paste with various seasonings. It's usually served raw, lop dip, which means raw, and then lop dip luet is lop dip with the blood of the animal whose meat you're eating congealed and poured over it. And fortunately, these people always, the Chinese traders in the little shops, or I don't recall where it all came from, but there was always either some kind of Japanese beer available or the local Lao Lao distilled spirits, which would help you get it down. And
would be spiced up too.
Oh yeah, very nicely spiced.
Yeah,
and
that would help.
Yeah, it was. You know, it wasn't. I unfortunately, you know, it was a little difficult for me, and I would try to get by swallowing it in larger pieces. And if it was like duck that had the bone incorporated in it, that would get hung up in your throat. And so anyway, but that was. I did that, the actual time that this took when I was in Vientiane was very little. Mm-hmm. I would make, you know, weekly visit over to the chief of veterinary services, and basically all he wanted from me was things that he could get and either sell himself or his underlings would sell on the black market, et cetera, and kind of give me the runaround, and then we'd get reports of animals dying someplace, and they would want us to come and find out why they were dying. We'd get a plane and fly somewhere, and by the time we got there, the animals were dead and buried, a little burned or something a long time ago, or eaten, and that was a futile effort, and somebody would say, well, they died of hemorrhagic septicemia or some other thing that they had conjured up, and maybe they did, and maybe they didn't, and we'd get them some vaccine. But, so that took very little time, and we were asked, that was when the crisis was occurring in Tsing Huang with the male Hmong having been run off the PDJ. And we're in the mountains around the flaming jars.
Okay.
And they were supplying them principally by airdrops.
Uh-huh.
And I went out to the airport and began helping load planes and work in the airport into the refugee business for a while, and then the next thing I was on the planes kicking rice and things of that nature. Then I'm trying to think of, so I was kind of doing a mixture of occasional veterinary activities to the Royal Royal Government, along with getting more and more involved in the, it was under the Community Development, the Office of Aid, but it was the refugee support, which was really the support of the Hmong family, the families of the Hmong soldiers. And of course, we all know what that was. So
you weren't the only volunteer though doing that, because I know there were some others who would say that.
When I would say George, Coward, I'm embarrassed to say this on the recorder that I can't remember
Shall I pause
well,
it?
No, that's all right. Cowart, he would be in here.
Oh.
Geez, was a wonderful person.
Okay.
But I can't call his first name.
Well, I can look up his last name.
But anyway, he was working up country with Pop. Pop and, I keep wanting to say Noel Coward.
Walter.
Walt Coward, yeah.
He's, by the way, now with the Ford Foundation in New York.
Oh, he is. He had been out west in one of the western states, I'd heard. Huh? But anyway, Walt and Pop were working up country.
Uh-huh.
And I just envied the heck out of them. That they were working up there and doing something
yeah.
more exciting than I was doing.
Yeah.
But I was beginning, along with my veterinary responsibilities, working down in Vientiane on that, and then going into some of the villages around, closer to Vientiane, and then we get to the surface transportation system, so-called refugee needs. And then later on in the two-year period, Bob Ziegler, or the AID, or whoever it was, decided to start a community development program up in Sayaburi, the village of Sayaburi, which was uh-huh. the provincial capital of Sayaburi province.
Uh-huh.
And I was selected, or I don't recall how, I'm sure I was quite eager to do it, to go up to Sayaburi, since really the veterinary end of things was pretty well collapsed and it was a waste of time, and start a community development program in Sayaburi. And so I went up and we rented a house, a very nice foundation house, clapboard, two-story, concrete floor and the ground floor. And I'm embarrassed to say I can't remember who all was up there with me.
Okay.
I can remember my Laotian, Kampui Sisavambong was my Laotian principal assistant. And again, as I look through those names, I would recognize some of them. I was up there initially pretty much by myself.
Uh-huh. Kind of the pioneer for that
yeah.
particular project.
And then later on, some of the other AID, IBS young men came up and
uh-huh.
we worked together. Joe Clipsey was up there.
Okay.
That's right. And Joe was up there. I don't recall whether Joe lived in that house or whether he lived somewhere else. Then there was a man, and I saw his name on there, and I can't recall it right now. He had a Vietnamese wife.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I can't remember. Was this, no, that was the I'm thinking of the fellow who might have had the Filipino wife.
No, that was Harold Walter.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
But this man, he had been in Southeast Asia, probably with IBS Vietnam.
Oh,
And then he came and with IBS Laos and was sent up. And but I was up there by myself a lot of the time.
Mm-hmm.
It was only in the latter months that they brought the rest of the team up there. And then there was, for a while, there was an AID advisor. His name was Smucker. And he was of this family that makes great jelly. And
with a name like that?
And he was a Mennonite man and a fine man, and I'm afraid we didn't treat him very well.
Oh.
Made rather light of him. But
because of his name?
Well, because of his name, and he was kind of a little farmer, you know.
Oh,
you know,
no.
Rather straight, and we were a long way from rather straight at that time. Pretty wild and woolly crew.
Uh-huh.
And I remember one night after a night of debauchery, we came home and were making light of his name rather loudly and crudely. And it occurred to us after we woke up and with our senses regained that he and his wife were just across a very thin panel wall. And he never said anything about it, and he was a fine person, and I'm sure that I should have been turned over a barrel and given some lashes for the way we carried on. But there was a road. First of all, when I went up there, there was a rather long and interesting tale about the year that the bamboo blooms. And I don't know. Bamboo does not bloom every year, and I can't remember the exact story now, but about every 7 years, the bamboo flowers, and then it dies. It seeds and dies, and I'm not a botanist, so I'm not sure it seeds, but it dies back, so there is no bamboo. And the bamboo rats, then, that live in the clumps of bamboo, when they need to eat, and they go into the rice fields. And eat the rice and decimate the rice crops. And so this was the year that the bamboo bloomed and died, and the rats had eaten the rice crops. And we were trying to, as a public relations, community development, anti-communist, whatever you want to call it, effort to help supply these villagers with rice. And, of course, which was all being stolen as fast as we were providing it by the Ta Sang.
Okay, we're defining Ta Sang.
Ta Sang is, of course, and then remember, this was 40 years ago, 35 years ago, and I'm dragging this out of my memory.
Yeah, I know.
But Laos was divided into provinces, and then the provinces were divided into Ta Sangs, and the Ta Sangs were divided into Mungs, which were like townships, you might say.
Okay.
And the Ta Sang maybe would be like the county. Or maybe it was the other way around. I don't know, but I think that's right.
Yeah.
And the Ta Sang was the elder or the appointed, not elected, but appointed executive officer of that unit of political measure called the Ta Sang.
Okay.
Okay. And so
they made sure that the rice was distributed.
And so we diddled around there helping. When I say we, it was really pretty much me, I believe. My field assistant, Tom Pui Sisabangbong, who is another story. But anyway, and we tried to see that the rice got where it was going, and we investigated and found the rice stored into the Ta Sang's house and blah, 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 which amounted to nothing. We dug a well behind our house to demonstrate these hand-dug wells, and we built an outhouse latrine to demonstrate that convenience. And it was a lovely place to live. It was typical low country Laos, with coconuts and betel nut and water buffaloes and rice paddy, and I loved it. It was lovely. You go to bed at night and here over on the Chow Lung's porch, and he was the governor. That was the term for governor. The little orchestra of local musical instruments with tinkling in the tropical night, you know, and it was we'd go down to the river every day about 4 o'clock for our baths, and it was a very idyllic existence, and we were trying to get a road in from Sai Buri to that next down in South where they were stealing rice. I can't remember the name of that. And there was a man named Dave. I'll think of it. He was an AID well technician. He was a well specialist. Dave, anyway.
They had specialists that many. Yeah.
Oh, AID had a lot of specialists. And Dave would get out. Most of his assistant was named Soon Torn. He was a time man. And they went out into the boonies. Dave was
really
fearless. And got into some pretty narrow scrapes.
Uh-huh.
But they had this mechanism for driving wells using the Jeep, taking the rear wheel off of the Jeep and putting a drum on it and setting up a tripod and lifting and dropping a hammer type of device to drive a well into the ground. And then
that would work pretty quick.
Yeah, and it was, and so Dave came up, Dave Bushman.
Mm-hmm.
And set up, and put up quite a few wells, and they were very, very favorably received, to say the least.
Oh, yeah,
Good clean drinking water as opposed to river water.
Mm-hmm.
And there was an Operation Brotherhood in Cyberi.
Mm-hmm.
That's the Filipino medical program. There was, at the time we called them, they were called White Star, which was Special Forces.
Okay.
B team there that I pretty much hung out with most of the time, American companionship when I felt the need. And
what would they think of you?
Me?
Yeah.
Well, they thought a lot of me.
Okay.
I mean, I knew a lot more than they did.
Uh-huh. Okay.
I
they didn't think you were, geez, what are you doing out there? You're nuts. You know, you're not armed and all that kind of stuff. And
well, they might have thought I was nuts, but I think they had pretty high regard for us.
Okay.
Because we got stuff done. And they pretty much, see, they were really restricted in what they could do.
Okay.
And we maybe had some restrictions, but if we did, we didn't pay much attention to them. And, you know, pretty well did what we wanted to do. Probably even more effective than they were.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Special Forces was supposed to be trained in third country, or second, you know, in
third world
lifestyles and how to get along and things, but I don't know how their training was. I'm sure it was very good, but in application of the field, they're human beings, and mostly southeastern United States farm boys not terribly sensitive to the native culture, to say the least.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so we had a happy little, and there was a family of American missionaries, Reverend Tubbs and his wife. His kids were in boarding school in the United States. They were with the American Missionary Alliance. And I got on well with him, too. And he, you know, we all kind of, it was an interesting little community of Americans with Reverend Tubbs and Special Forces and myself.
Yeah,
and,
it's quite a spectrum.
Yeah. And then so I, trying to remember the sequence of events. From there, it was decided, Walt Cowart went home. His tour ended, and he went back to States. And it was decided that I would go up and replace him on the Longchamp. In the site, 98. And that's where Pop was.
Yeah, so
and
that's
so,
what you wanted, actually.
Yeah, I was, so I went up there, moved up there. General Glenn Powell made me a little house about half the size of this dining room, and it was just as nice and cozy as it could be, right on the edge of the runway when they first set up in Longchamp. And so I was in Longchamp.
What time that would that have been? I know that you were there for 2 years, so
it would have probably been
your first couple months was just Veterinary, and then and then how long
in Cyberi?
Cyberi is
probably the better part of a year.
Okay.
I'm guessing.
So you've got less than a full year left.
Yeah.
And so then you get up.
Yeah, so I went up to Longcheng.
Okay.
And at that time, Longcheng was the center. There was no other operations center there.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, that was the center of the so-called secret war.
Mm-hmm.
And we were there for several months. And then because of Pop's fame or notoriety, the reporters down in Vientiane were getting wind of this operation. And so it was decided that Pop and I would move across the ridge to Sam Tong and set up a cover base there
To attract the reporters, but keep them away from
Longcheng.
Yeah.
And so we moved over to Sam Tong, built some warehouses, or had the, you know, worked with the local people to build. When we say warehouses, we're talking about 55-gallon gasoline drums that had been flattened out and nailed to upright posts for siding thatch roof, and that's, we stored our supplies in there, principally medical supplies, some agricultural supplies.
So you actually used it?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
And then we had a set up, when I say we, I'm not sure exactly how all of this evolved. Each of the Hmong, and they weren't all Hmong, but Kamu and Yao.
Yao would have been there.
Their special forces had a medic, and we helped set them up with hospitals. When we say hospitals, we're talking about an aid station with a dirt floor and a thatch roof, or maybe a tin roof, and some bamboo cots, and some rudimentary medications, malaria control, chloroquine, etc. And began distributing that, getting them on the payroll. And then Pop started a program training some teachers. He would find young men in the military who had some education, who were at least literate, and maybe had gone through several years of primary school, and we would send them out into these villages where the indigenous special forces.
Okay.
Teams were set up little schools. AID provided educational materials. After a certain amount of arm twisting, and we got that in there, and essentially small community development programs based around Bang Pao's troops in all of these outlying villages, and I spent, I don't know how many hundreds of hours in a Helio Courier flying around from village to village. They dropped me off, I would spend a day or two a combination of public relations and intelligence gathering and a need assessment, etc. Sometimes I would hike from one village to another and get picked up. There were occasional periods, and I can't quite remember what caused, why, but I would be asked to go down, say, maybe into southern Laos. They would send up a plane, pick me up, and fly me into Vientiane.
Pause. taking it off pause so that we can finish this little bit of story.
But anyway, occasionally I would be asked to go someplace else. There was a quoted outbreak of a disease or something. So I would go down into, I went several trips down into the Plateau Boulevards, down in Pasadena, or Savannah Kett. I visited just about every province. I remember some very harrowing airplane flights. Going through the rainy season and thunderstorms.
And low level.
Well, either that or very high level when you think, what in the world is this single engine airplane doing up at 30 grand in a thunderstorm?
Yeah,
you know?
Right. Yeah. This is not smart.
With no oxygen. But anyway, but I would go out occasionally for an occasional veterinary effort, but you know, they were just kind of a perfunctory show the flag type of thing. Really almost no veterinary medicine done of any consequence at all. So spaying a few of the AID personnel's pets on my ironing board. So I remember operating on one dog at the Operation Brother Vet Hospital. I think I spayed it or something. Frank Daly, one of the ops officers for the aircraft program, had a little dog with chronic. I think she had a transmissible venereal tumor, which is a viral-induced tumor in dogs. And she ran around with her rear end swollen up and hanging out all the time, and I was so frequently called upon to minister to this poor little dog's needs, and there wasn't much you can do for her.
Yeah.
Okay, well, maybe
we should turn this off and then a bit of a break and playing with the dog. And okay, so we're back. Let's see. You just talked about Okay. I have, you know, we talked a little bit earlier, and you mentioned a few things, and but I've never met anybody who knew Buell. You know, I'd read, you know, the some of the articles, and
Bob Ziegler knows him,
but I haven't met him.
I presume you will.
So, first of all, how did you get the nickname Pop?
Well, because when he, do you know Pop's history?
No,
I mean,
not
as far as how he got with IBS and.
Well, he had he was already retired.
He was a retired
farmer.
I don't know whether he was how retired he was, but he was a farmer in northwestern Ohio. And
he was buried back in his hometown.
Yeah, I went to his funeral.
Oh, okay.
And his wife died. And he was just devastated.
Right.
And he was looking for some way to fill the gap. And thought he could lose himself and his, you know, overcome his grief. By doing something like this, and I don't know how he learned of IVS versus some other agency.
Right.
Of course, that was pre-Peace Corps.
Right.
And but he somehow he learned about it, and he went over in the early days of IVS Laos, and certainly he was by far the senior member of the IVS group, and that's why they called him Pop.
Oh, okay.
Just
all right.
Because he was the oldest one there.
Oldest in chronology, as well as one of the oldest IBS people.
Yeah, but he was, you know, certainly there were IBSers before him in Laos. I don't, not many. I don't think we had much of a program. And then, of course, when I knew Pop, he was working with Hmong up on the up in the Sinh Quang province, and
was he still IBS?
No, he was AID.
Okay.
And but he was coordinating the refugee, the Hill Tribes refugee program up there.
Right.
And so, and he was there when I came, and he was there when I left.
Oh yeah, yeah. He was there until 75.
Yeah. and he went to he retired in the Philippines.
Mm-hmm.
And died in Manila.
Mm-hmm.
And was brought back to his hometown and spoke fluently. And there was a, quite a group, Van Powell and all of his cortege or entourage were there.
Uh-huh.
And quite a few of the AID, a lot of the Air America guys, other types, and it was a, really it's the only get together I've had with the people from Laos since I left.
Right.
And his daughter Harriet lives right down here in Thornville, southern mm-hmm. part of Lincoln County, and I get a Christmas card from her every year. And see, our son Luke is named for the Roman Catholic priest who worked in our program, believe it or not, Father Luke Bouchard. Now, when I say he worked in our program, he was there under the auspices of the Roman Catholic. He was an oblate
mm-hmm.
in the oblate order from Rhode Island.
Mm-hmm.
And but he was working, doing missionary work with the tribes people, particularly the Kamu, which was very low social, on the low social order. He would go out and then also there were quite, there were a few Catholic men,
mm-hmm.
and he would visit the various villages and minister to the Catholics' needs in these tribal groups. How they became Catholic, I'm not real sure, but he was one of the reasons I thought of him as being, of so many people, whether it was Pop or a lot of the people in Laos during those years, did very heroic and things, but most all of them had some underlying drive, you know, whether it was to be an adventure or money or something, you know,
uh-huh.
ego. But I, you know, the only thing I could discern in Father Bouchard was just a real desire to help these people.
Uh-huh.
I mean, no one knew him. You know, he didn't get any money. He went into the worst places. He didn't come in every weekend to Vientiane for R&R. And he would live in these Kamu villages in the most terrible circumstances and just, you know, joke about it. He'd tell about how he'd come in and there was a Catholic family in this one Kamu village and the Air America would drop him off there and he would find his way to their hut and they'd be surprised to see him and say, "Dear Father, you know, how nice to have you. And, you know, we don't have anything to eat. I'll go out and tend my traps."
And
they'd go out and bring in rats from the they trapped out in the fields and have them for dinner.
Mm-hmm.
And he's talking about eating bat, and I was asking how bat tastes. And he said, "Well, it's a lot like rat, but, you know."
with wings.
Yeah. Kind of cross between rat and chicken, I guess. But anyway, but just very self, facing, just a very brave man because mm-hmm. he just went into places where if the Catholic Lao could have gotten hold of him, they would have had his head on a stake. You know?
Mm-hmm.
And he was a very strong force just in his presence. In generating favorable attitudes towards Americans. And,
mm-hmm.
and of course, Catholics were very strongly anti-communist in those days, in that arena.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was not very well thought of by the opposing forces.
But they never caught him?
No. In fact, after Laos fell, he visited us in New Jersey when we were living there.
Mm-hmm.
And of course he's the only person. What made me think of Father Bouchard was Pop's daughter Harriet, The only person I know who has maintained a real good contact with Frank Bouchard, he went from there to Indonesia, down to Borneo, and was working with the tribes in Borneo. And I feel bad because he has been back on home leave and visited Harriet when we were here in Ohio, and I didn't know it till after he'd left. But anyway.
And she didn't think to tell him?
Well, I don't know, but I didn't know about it.
Too bad.
He probably had a lot of people to see and busy itinerary. Probably usually, people who come back from those circumstances have malaria and all other kinds of problems and not feeling too great, you know. Which, I don't know, but I haven't seen him since he would visit us in New Jersey. But, he was a real hero. But,
so, what was, even though when you knew him, he was no longer in IBS, what was Pop Buell like? Just, you know, as a person.
Yeah, he was a very charismatic, let me interrupt and say I've got a lot of photographs.
I think either you or Barbara Benfield mentioned that.
And I have some of Pop, etc. But Pop was short in stature, not real short for a man of his age and time. I would imagine Pop was, probably 5'8", 5'7", to 5'8". Not a muscular build, but a very, he was a farmer. Not a weightlifter.
Right.
You know, he was a very physically able person.
Mm-hmm. Solid.
Solid, yeah. And balding. And when I knew him, of course, he was, I suppose, younger than I am now, which is hard to believe, because he would have been in his 50s. And steel gray hair, what there was of it, and chain smoker. And I don't know how many of these things to say about him now. The recording.
I could always pause things.
Well, let's pause things and talk a little bit, and then we'll decide. I don't want to do anything to undermine Pop's. I have very.
You like the man.
But he was a.
No one wants to hurt him.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm putting it back on again. So I was asking about Pop.
He was a very. As I said, charismatic, both for the Americans, but particularly for the Laotian people, because he could, he spoke terrible Lao.
But
he always communicated very effectively, through waving and shouting and his pidgin Lao. I'm not suggesting that I was fluent by any means, but... I was by comparison with Pop.
Yeah. But that doesn't mean that there are degrees that anybody can say.
He worked very closely with Van Kaal and the more, as well as the civilian refugee people of, in the Moon organization. And he was obviously able to lead them very effectively, both by... strength of will as well as strength of character, and he was a good organizational man. He could, he could dominate anyone from the ambassador or probably the secretary of state on down in a meeting. Because he was very emotional. He was like a evangelist for his cause of the tribal refugees, and he'd bring tears to your eyes playing their cause. And of course, the tragedy of it was that, and I worked in that situation, and candidly, I was pretty effective too, and it was a we did a terrible thing. Because we led these people into a situation that, and then left them. So the Pop was a very charismatic person and a very effective leader and a very effective program man. He could carry things out.
Mm-hmm.
He could work in Washington or he could work in San Tom with equal effectiveness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think when, I don't know if you mentioned it now, but when the tape was off, you said that he was something like a father to you, too.
Yeah.
So really taking you under his wing.
Yeah, and...
So it was more than just a work relationship,
yeah,
and more than just a...
Well, almost every relationship in those circumstances is more than a work relationship.
Yeah.
You know, look at John Wayne leading his Marines up the shores of San Iwo Jima. You know, he looked at them as his boys, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And in those situations, you don't have just a work relationship.
Yeah.
So we lived day to day. You never knew
mm-hmm.
what the next day was going to bring, and we took care of each other. So.
Were there any other IBS folks who were assigned along with you to him? At least at your time.
Yeah.
You can't necessarily comment about other things that
yeah.
you weren't there, so I don't want
to... All right. I'm trying to keep right now to the IBS period because, of course, after IBS, I went with AID,
mm-hmm.
and really nothing changed.
Okay.
And so I'm having a hard time separating out things
as
to who
okay.
I was working for at what point in time.
Mm.
And after I left Sam Tong and was asked to go over into Lusing province. I can't even remember. Ban Hui Sai was the provincial capital there,
uh-huh.
and Flipsy had been in Ban Hui Sai. Joe Flipsy had been in Ban Hui Sai working on a community development program,
uh-huh.
Flipsy was a very colorful character, he was working there, and I came in and. I don't remember whether Joe was going back to the States or exactly the sequence of things. But he was leaving Ban Hui Sai and I came in. And but I had set up I need a map to remember these names. The Yao had lost their villages up in northern northwestern Laos.
This may not be good enough.
That will take. Okay. No, it's not. It's Hui Sai's on here, but anyway, from the Tom Dooley.